Okay, I'm here. It's April 23rd, 1996, and I'm here with Judy Salas. And we're going to start off our interview by asking, when did you move to Alaska and why did you move here?
I came to Alaska in a prop plane in 1960. There were no jets then. To be married, and my husband-to-be was Ernie, who was hired by the Weather Bureau there in Cordova at mile 13. Anchorage at that time was fully spread out with a population of just 80,000. It was like living in a time of Little House on the Prairie. It was a very different Alaska then. There was honesty and trust, and people helped one another. There was also a time of excitement, like driving down the road system and crossing it with a huge brown bear with her three cubs. The cubs were curious. And they kept coming towards the car, but the mom, she reared up, she was really just waving her paws to the brush. And the cubs casually turned around towards the brush, decided to go back to their mom. But once again, when mom wasn't looking, they sneaked back out. And there she was. We hit the gas and we moved. Cordova had wonderful wooden sidewalks. And then one day after a movie, we saw the Magnificent Seven, and we all did a Yul Brynner walk over these wooden sidewalks and through the middle of the road, and we really got in the feel of being in the West. Cordova also had its first ice worm festival in 1961, and we had a great time there, lots of games. Sidney Lawrence, he was a wonderful painter and still has captured much of the beauty of Alaska. But the reality of seeing the actual beauty of the Northern Lights roll across the sky, such an array of colors, no words or canvas can really describe, and that's what we saw in Cordova. Also, the snow glistens through the sun as the sun comes up and just falls across all of the mountains. It is so beautiful, even looking at those mountain goats walk across it. Everyone took life in stride. No one had the pressures and the need to perform there. The ferry system wasn't in yet. There was only one ferry, and I believe it went as far as Skagway. There was an unwritten law that you must pick up a hitchhiker because of the weather conditions and because you never left a person stranded. And that's how we happened to come to Cordova. And we went on to Bethel, and Bethel had permafrost. Cordova had running water, but not so in Bethel. We had the running water on our compound, but it was because there was 46 houses and the government built a well. But in town, there was only one well, and it was a dip method. So all the water was dipped into great big barrels. I understand it's much more sophisticated now, but not at that time. And so, when we were there, the school teacher asked me, I was working at the bank, Bob McKay was the manager there, and he said, what did I think about politics concerning the honey basket system that we have? I had no idea what he was talking about, and he realized that's who he asked me where I lived. Well, I told him, and he asked me what I had for a toilet. So I described what I had for a toilet. It was square, and it was in the bathroom, and it had a little lever on it. Well, he said, you must have a well. We said yes. So he proceeded to say that there was no well in Bethel. And they had this wooden honey bucket truck. And as it went, it creaked and it had some problems with it. And he felt that they should be getting a more a standard honey bucket. We had Honey Bucket Lake, which all of this honey bucket stuff went into, and it was right next to the Catholic Church there. And we all ice skated on it in the wintertime. And no one knew anything different. So anyway, then we were driving, we had a little bug, and we wound up behind the honey bucket. Well, this little man, bigger than a minute, runs across to the Swanson apartment, goes upstairs, and he's gone for a minute, and traffic is kind of backed up, and he runs back down, and runs up this little ladder, and dumps in his little bucket. I told my husband, please, let's stay back a little bit. But after hearing the story from the school teacher, I didn't want to have any part of this little wooden truck. And once my husband realized what the truck was carrying, we definitely slowed down and went back and did not try to get in the way of the penny bucket truck. Then there was a school teacher, and it was sometimes it was depressing because he was there, the winters were kind of long, and there was even one time in the mid-60s where the winter was into June, and we had snowdrifts still in the airport, and the breakup hadn't even begun yet. And in the meantime, this one school teacher had disappeared. No one knew where she went. They couldn't find her. They just didn't know if it was foul play. Anyway, they couldn't find her anywhere. And so breakup was coming, and with such a breakup, because of the ice was so heavy that year, we even rowed, everyone who had boats, took boats into town to do their grocery shopping. It was such excitement in the town, and wore hip waders and everything, because after the long winter, this was a fun time. We all enjoyed it, and up popped the school teacher out of Honey Bucket Lake. So no one still knows to this day what happened, or she just lost her way or what, but anyhow, the mystery was solved. And during that time, the Kuskokwim River decided to change its course. Well, the way it was, all the old cemetery was right there. And so a lot of the graves were falling into the water. So they decided that they had to move the cemetery. So when they moved the cemetery, they moved it to the other side of town. And because of the 3 feet permafrost in Bethel, it took a lot of digging and a lot of moving.
Who was it that moved the graves? Was it the government, or who was it?
No, just the townspeople, different ones, just decided that they had to salvage what they had left, because the river was taking quite a bit for the family.
How far off did the river change its course?
It moved several 10 feet or more, possibly 20 at the time, because they built a retaining wall to keep it from taking any more of the land and the road. So they were having to move the road now, because the road was right there along the river. And so they had to even move that back, so they built this retaining wall to hopefully stop the erosion. And the Eskimo was very friendly, and of course, drinking was a way of life. Bethel was a dry town. They always voted it dry. They always managed to do that. The Eskimo, most of them did sign their signature with an X, so a lot of them probably didn't vote. And it was very exciting to have to witness their signature on the back of their checks and stuff like that. They always took their time and had to be precise. And so when the bootlegger realized what a thriving business he could have, he was selling the bottles for $25 a bottle. And the Eskimo and everyone was there and wanted one knew to go to him. The trouble was having a hard time finding a secret place, because as he flew down, he'd always have a different place landing somewhere else. And once when the trooper did get him, the word was out that he beat up the trooper so bad, the trooper was asking to get out of Bethel. He didn't want any more part of him. And the bootlegger's name was Chet Adkins, and at that time there was a singer called Chet Adkins too. And my husband and I were walking, and I hit him and said, "That's Chet Adkins." And I'm thinking, maybe we should go to a different store. I don't want any part of this situation. And they said he was very explosive. And my husband says, "Oh, the singer?" No. And then I was really concerned, but nothing happened. It went really smooth. And then, go ahead. Do you have another question?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. And then the Eskimos, they had two types of apparel. They would wear their pockets in the wintertime, and then they had the cusbacks in the summer. And the cusbacks, if the hood was rounded, that belonged to a part of different area of villages, like we'll say to the north. Then if they were pointed, and they had the pointed, then they knew they came from the other direction. So from afar off, they could wave to each other and know exactly who was who. And they had different colors, and the parkas were always done. They would set the skins up so that they would match. They couldn't just lay skins any which way. They would have to lay them up so that they would match up beautifully, so that it had a flair to it. and creativity. And they sewed everything with dental floss. It seemed to hold it together really good. And of course, we were chichacos, like the greenhorns or gustics, as we were called, and we had in Bethel no medical privileges. We were at the mercy of the dentist, the visiting dentist, and we were at the mercy of the anyone who did eyes, the eye examinations, and we had only the natives were allowed, Alaska Native, at the Alaska Native Hospital when they were. So we had a Dr. Jackson. She looked like a Norse woman. She was a real big lady, and she's so tender-hearted. She was a great gal. And then she got married. So she was the one that handled all of the medical needs there in Bethel. And one time there was a murder. When you're in Bethel, if you have a bottle, you drink it till it's gone. It's not you just take a few drinks. You drink it till it's gone, and then you leave. But excuse me, this one time, it got out of hand, and the brothers were having an argument. The twin brothers, and one shot the other one. Well, they sent the body to Anchorage, and this one came knocking at the door because he had heard the body had been to Dr. Sherman, and she thought she was seeing a ghost. It just really scared her. She couldn't believe it. And then she realized that the brother had to have been an identical twin. And he was fine. Everything was fine. It was just he couldn't handle that kind of drinking. And in Alaska, when you went on the airplane, mostly everyone brought their own fist. They just didn't. They didn't sell liquor on the airplane. And, of course, they brought on their own shotguns. They brought on their own pistols, whatever, because there was no federal regulations at the time. But of course, tourists were having a fit, and they wanted that little curtain to make them first class. And so some of the airplanes were putting on that little curtain. My friend Susan Murphy's mother is Nora Gwynn, and she was and is the only Native Eskimo judge in Bethel and of all of Alaska. We were buying the furs from, there was a Maggie Lind, and she would make the ruffs on the fur parkas because it was so cold that when you, first they would put the wolverine and then they would put the wolf over it, and you would close it like this and you would have a moisture in there where you could breathe. And the air was so cold you could actually get tuberculosis in your lungs. So, while we were buying the ruffs from the Eskimo ladies and everything, and our husbands were and going to work with them, the teenagers didn't want that style anymore. So they were going to see us robots, buying leather jackets, not putting hats on their heads. And they looked like they were pretty frozen to us, but sometimes we don't want the old styles and traditions, so we try to break it. Alaska was very isolated, and because of the running water that we did have on the compound, we took in a lot of nuns from St. Mary's. They would come down in twos, and they had these long skirts that was the old days, 40 yards, I believe, the material. Anyway, they couldn't stay at the Catholic Church at that time because there wasn't any really running water. It was still the dip method, and food wasn't very plentiful. It was just unusual circumstances. So they just lived at our house. They would come in, and then the plane, they could make connections, and they would get back and just go right over to the airport, because it was just a hop, skip, and a jump, and away. They would go, and this one time this nun, her skirt went over the brake, and my husband was driving her, and he didn't want to ask her if he could release his brake, he didn't know, embarrass himself, and all. So he put out the brakes in the car. We had mushers, and the mushers showed up. They were all Eskimo. There was no Iditarod as we know it today. And one year, there was up to 70 mushers, and they were all in their parkas, and of course, they put like a seal oil coating over their skin, which protects them from the cold. The dogs always were fed just fish whatever they ate off the side of the land. And the sleds during the summertime would be on the roofs of all of the Eskimo houses, wherever, whoever had a sled, that's where it stayed for the summer months. And the Eskimos were letting the dogs kind of run loose. And then, but when it was winter, then they went back and they would go from over the Kuskokwim River, they would go to the trading post, they would trade their skins. And then they would go to the fur rendezvous. The fur rendezvous, the winners would go there. And that was held in Anchorage. And little Joe Cartwright from Bonanza, you know, what's his name? Michael Landing was there that year, and he was leading the fur rendezvous parade. And my husband got a chance to meet him. And he said he was very down to earth, very nice. And then when he was leaving the parade, his horse slipped on the ice and fell. But Michael Landon was okay. Everything worked out okay.
Tell us about where else did you live in Alaska?
Okay, then we moved on to King Salmon. And King Salmon, well, one time had Jimmy Dean, noted for his, he was a singer and noted for his sausages. He came up to King Salmon, and he did all his fishing with there. Well, that was always the big news for the day. And also, there wasn't any TV in Cordova, Bethel, but now in King Salmon, we were able to have some TV. So it was from the base, because there's there we had some hookups, but before that there wasn't even any satellite. And believe it or not, we didn't even miss it. I wonder how we kept so busy. And so the movies would start with the news at 5 o'clock that afternoon, and then the late show would be 10 o'clock that evening. And we had at one time a series of Mae West, which none of us even know who she was, but we had this opportunity of meeting Mae West. We understood why. We never knew why, who she was. She was it was quite an experience. And we all had to homeschool our children into a certain age level at the school because we didn't have enough teachers to go around on the compound. We're back on the compound there.
Did you have children in King Salmon?
Yes, we had a kindergarten. She was kindergarten in first grade, and then we had Mary, who was born in Bethel. We got stuck in the snowbank, the bug did, and my husband says, well, you better get out and help push. Well, I thought at the time it wasn't a good idea. We made it in time to Dr. Jackson, since she was born immediately as we hit her porch. And then in King Salmon, we had Kitty at home, and the neighbor next door had just watched some movies on birthing, and our neighbor of the compound had been in this 25 years ago. So they told my husband to start boiling water, and after we got everything done in the bedroom and the baby was just perfect, I said, why do you have him boiling water? Because they kept laughing how he keeps boiling, refilling all four burners. They said, keep the husband busy so he doesn't get upset. One pot is for the string and for the scissors, and then to sit down and enjoy lots of coffee. And then we had, and then Joe, he was born there, but we made it to Dillingham. We flew over to Dillingham, and it was in a small aircraft, of course, and was in Dr. Libby's home, who was very popular at the time, and he just came just fast, just went in that office, and there he came, and there it was. Exciting to be ready to climb on a plane, come back home. So King Salmon was very exciting, and Priest, everyone, he used to always visit us. We had marriages in our houses, because if he was doing a ceremony or something, he would just come right to the house, and he'd tell me to be ready in a couple hours or whatever, the priest would, and so I witnessed several marriages and then we had at Arnie's Bar. Everyone went to Arnie's Bar. That's where you had dinner or lunch. If you ever went out, you went to Arnie's Bar or you went to the base. And at Arnie's Bar, this movie star needed someone to take the meat because he wanted the rack, but he didn't want the moose, the rest of the moose. So he allowed my husband and the next door neighbor his airplane. They flew to the place where the moose was, and both of us had a freezer full of moose that year. We didn't have to do anything about it, just get chartered.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a school teacher there that taught. She was able to teach 3 or 4 grades at a time, and she had lots of beautiful ivory artifacts and fur parkas and things. And her son was flying out of Nome, and so eventually she retired and went to Finland. But she was wonderful. We learned a lot from her. And the base was convenient because it did offer bowling and it did offer movies and a night. You know, you could always do something to get away. But my husband had a boat, and when a lot of times people from Washington, D.C. would come up and just give Alaska a look around, see how it was. And they always wanted to go with the king salmon, so they would come up, and I remember they went fishing with my husband, and it was wonderful because they did catch the salmon, which was wonderful. And they would go with their slacks on, their brand new shoes, their $300 suit in the boat. It was kind of cute. But they got their salmon, and then they would go back and kept it frozen. They'd keep it frozen. They would stay at our house and eat, and it was really a nice way of life. Not like it is now. It was really different.
And how long did you live in Cordova? I mean, in King Salmon?
We lived there about 3 years, and then we went on to Annette Island. And Annette Island is the Metlakatla, is the only Indian reserve in all of Alaska, and they're the Tsimshian Indians. And we had a Coast Guard base there at that time, so we have public school system right there where the Coast Guard base was. And so a lot of the kids from Metlakatla did take, go to school. We all went to school together, but there was another school in Metlakatla there also. And they had a different type of cooking altogether. Like the Eskimo had a gudeg, and of course Eskimo ice cream that was made with seal oil, and they had now gone to Crisco, and they would beat it till like it fluffed. And they would put some sugar, and they always had berries, so it depended on the kind of berries that were really in that year, but that's kind of Eskimo ice cream you had. And of course salmon was always in, and they smoked salmon and did a lot of stuff like that in Bethel. Salmon was the biggest treat, canned any which way. They even buried the heads. They would bury the heads in the area there, and fold them all up in cloth, and when they're ready to have a big soup, they would under it, take them in, drop them in the pot, and have them a salmon head soup. And we had Lean's Lodge, but going back to Bethel, we had Lean's Lodge, and that was about the only place where people could stay, and there were really not locks on the door, you know, it would just be like a little hook on the doors. And people were very honest in that. And I remember in King Salmon, too. We had gone on a charter from Bethel to King Salmon at one time. And we stayed in Arnie's Lodge. Arnie's Bar, Lodge, you know, cafe, he had it all. That was it. And they told all of us on the charter who had what rooms. Well, then next thing you know, you walk up there, and Arnie was giving out permission to different people so that whoever wanted to stay in the same room, he was allowing everybody to have the same room. So we wound up that night putting lots of stuff against the door. Artie wasn't giving anyone else that room anymore because he gave it up a few times there. And then Lean Lodge was the same way, and they had bearskin rug, and it was just really laid back. And we worked for back to Bethel too when I was working for Wing Consolidated. One is Jimex came in from Jimex Flying Service, and it was really, it was cold, it was a whiteout, it was really a very bad situation. But it was clearing up, and he came in. As he flew in, somehow the plane was having a mechanical problem, tipped over, and he got out through the opening. The mechanics, everyone was running towards the plane, and he danced all over the airplane in his white outfit, like he was just Superman. He just was so, it was so funny. It was so neat to see this. And then once the F-27 was coming in, and it was just coming in, and the wind was blowing, he just came coming in, and he landed his landing gear actually hit the ground. But he knew the conditions were so icy he wasn't going to make it. So he reared back on the throttle there, and he made it back to Anchorage. None of us still know how he was able to do that. And he put on that poor little plane and shouldn't have done it. They made him good in those days. That was really exciting. And like one time the mail truck couldn't get into Bethel because it was blowing so bad and the storm was that the mail had to get into Bethel and it had to get into the town. So they all took their shovels and they kept shoveling. It took them I don't know how many hours to go through. It was 3 miles from town to go 3 miles. It took them hours to get that mail truck into town, shoveling behind, shoveling in front. And they said that was one of the important days of their life. They thought they didn't have to come back to work after that. Mr. Wise was a senator at that time from Bethel, and the governor of Alaska did come and visit Bethel, and he said it was the mud hole of Alaska. Of course, there were no sidewalks, and there was just lots of mud. And Eddie Hoffman was a very influential man. He was Eskimo, and he wanted the best for Alaska. He did everything to bring unity and to bring progress, and he was very influential. And I remember one time we were having a big sale in Northern Commercial Company, because it wasn't AC then. And he said, "So, why should I buy your pie?" So I gave him several reasons, and he had already made up his mind he was going to buy it anyway, but we have to go through all of these little fun things, you know. It was just exciting. Eddie Hoffman did do a lot for the community and for everybody that was there. Basket weaving, we had a babysitter who was from Tuninik. She did excellent basket weaving, and so she had to quit because she was going to get married, and Nancy Hunter came from Scammon Bay. So when Nancy came, she was there for a short time when her aunt was pregnant with number 8. So Nancy, they feel free about bringing their relatives. And so she brought Rosalie Hunter. And Rosalie stayed with us for a good 2 weeks, if I remember right. And when she first ate and stayed, I thought she was going to go into town with her relatives. Well, the next thing I know is Nancy says, "Good night, everybody," and we all said good night. Nancy and Rosalie went up the stairs, and they just stayed in Nancy's room. So anytime Nancy had friends, we knew they were staying for a time. We didn't know how long, but everyone shared their food in common. We never thought anything about it one way or the other. And the priest one time brought a goose, and it was out of season, and he had this brown bag. And he kept talking, and we had company. And he kept, and Bernie kept saying to him, "Well, do you want me to do something with the brown bag?" He says, "Oh, no, that's okay, that's okay." So finally, when the company left, he opened it up, and there's this goose. Well, Father Coracle said, "I'm coming back at 5 o'clock to eat it." Well, I never cooked a goose in my life, so I ran around the compound trying to figure out how to cook a goose. But they just invited themselves. They would just invite themselves to come and join me. It was just one of those things that was done. It was so, it was neat. It was good life. Good life. And,
Okay. When Where were you during the 64 earthquake?
Okay, we were in Bethel. And again, that was a very, very sad day. And when we were there, a nun and a friend of mine had just come to just getting sick. We didn't realize the tundra was rolling. And we all told ourselves in our mind, we're in flat land, this cannot be an earthquake. But it was so severe, we almost fell off the chairs because it was going. And everyone had ham radios, and they kept in touch with everybody. That was the only communication we had. And of course, Anchorage was being, it was a disaster area. And we had, what we had on the compound was called Morse code phone. Like, if you were one signal, we would take the ringer and we would turn it one long one. And if I had, and if our family was one short, we would go zip, one short. And wherever you were on the compound, whoever was looking for whoever, they would use, you would just go down the list and find out your name and what your Morse code was. And you, wherever house you were at, you would just pick up the phone because you were, because you knew it was you. They could always find you where you were at. And so that when a few people were under the, they were doing things in the firehouse and things like that, when the serious one. And of course we did go to Anchorage and did see Trinidad, and we did hear, there were more miracles. People that should have been killed, that should have been in their houses when they came down, were not.
It should have worked, because I
checked it out before.
Yeah, I tried it with some other tapes too.